session number 1204401.
Admiral McLean, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
In Bangalore, India.
How did that come about?
My father was in the Royal Scots, the regiment in India at the time. And that's how it occurred.
Was your father a professional soldier?
Yeah.
How long did you stay in India for?
Can't really remember, but I think about 6 months. And then we all came back to England, and my father, unfortunately, then died.
Where were you educated?
Wellington.
How did you decide to go into the Navy?
I can't tell you. I always wanted to. We lived by the sea in Northumberland, and maybe it was that.
Was it easy to get into Dartmouth?
Didn't get into Dartmouth. I went in through public school entry. Very few boys from Wellington went into the Navy.
How did one go about doing that?
Well, you took the same exam as the Army, but a much higher standard was required to get into the Navy. And then you went in as a cadet for a year to a training ship called the Erebus. And then you went to sea as a midshipman, and we joined up with the Dartmouth cadets who were a little younger than you, but the same seniority.
When was this that you got into the Navy, got your commission?
I got into the Navy in 1927, but I suppose we didn't get commission until we were sub-lieutenants, which was several years later. We were midshipmen until then.
Do you remember the Invergordon Mutiny?
Oh, yes.
Where were you and what do you remember about it, please?
I was in China, in a sub-lieutenant of a destroyer. And we heard the news on the ordinary news sheets. And there was no trouble in China. The only thing I do remember was that most of the ship's company who allotted, it was called, a lot of their pay home, had to come along. I was the accountant officer of the ship. They all had to reduce their allotments because of this pay reduction. But there was no trouble of any sort.
Why do you think there was no trouble on the China station?
I can't tell you. I can't tell you. The China station was not a really sort of place of large ships all huddled together like the home station. There was no set cruises and collection of ships like there was at Invergordon. So I suppose, and also the influence of what went on in England filtered through to the ships. I suppose really it was just that we were much really more separated from life. And really just interested in our own fleet and our own business.
Did any of the ratings grumble?
No. They were sad. The whole thing was sad. I remember no grumbling.
What did you and your brother officers feel about the reductions in pay?
Rather miffed. I don't think we weren't very well paid anyhow, so that the proportion we lost wasn't very great. I don't remember, personally, feeling outraged by it.
What did you feel about the mutineers?
I don't really remember. I think if the word astounded I used. Do you remember we were a long way away? It took 6 to 8 weeks to get a letter to China from England in those days. By the time we got real proper news of it, it was all settled and over.
What was your speciality in the Navy?
I went into navigation.
Why did you choose that?
I enjoyed handling the idea of handling ships and taking ships across the ocean and all that side of the Navy. At least I look forward to that.
At what stage did you feel that a war was coming?
I suppose from... I was in the Mediterranean and we kept on having crises. We first of all had Mussolini marching into Albania on Good Friday or whatever it was, 19... can't remember what year...
1939?
About 1937 or something. Didn't he go into Albania? And then we had the Abyssinian crisis that was, when was that, 37 or 38? When Mussolini, the Italians, went into Abyssinia. It was felt very much in the Mediterranean fleet, because each time in one of these crises we had to leave Malta and go to Alexandria, which was further away from the air threat of the Italian Air Force. So it meant a major upheaval each time.
What were you doing when the war declaration of 1939 was made?
I was in HMS Afridi, the leader of the tribal destroyers, in Alexandria, as usual, sheltering from the Italian Air Force. And we were immediately sent down the Red Sea to meet the Gloucester, the flagship of the Commander-in-Chief East Indies, who come up from Ceylon to have a rendezvous with us. And then we came back to Alexandria in about a month. This would be about October or something. And were told that our flotilla had to go back to the UK. So off we rushed from the Red Sea to Harwich we arrived, where we all crowded ashore to use the only telephone box available, ring up our wives and say, here we are, which presumably didn't break any laws of secrecy. Anyway, we were allowed to do it. And then we went up to Rosyth, where we were stationed off and on until I left the Afridi, or the Cossack, in them. I suppose something like March 1940.
What was it like serving on the tribal class destroyers in the war?
Well, I didn't really do long enough in the war in the tribal class destroyers to give you a good answer to that. I remember that our anti-aircraft armament was not really very effective. Otherwise, they were good ships. As Winnie probably said, weren't very well equipped with anti-submarine devices. None of us were.
This is Bob Winnie we're talking about.
Yes. Well, it was... we hadn't done a great deal of training in anti-submarine devices, and our ASDICs weren't all that effective. I don't think we'd really worked very hard at that side of our armament.
What kind of duties did the Afridi take up from Rosyth?
We escorted convoys up and down the east coast from London to the Firth of Forth, and we escorted international convoys from Norway, southern Norway. Norway is neutral then, of course, you realize, to Rosyth. We convoy escort.
Did you come across the enemy at all?
Aircraft, but no surface ships. Oh, I suppose we had MTBs, of course, on the east coast. And we had a lot of mining to contend with on the East Coast. We were lucky we didn't hit one.
People in the army and in civilian life talk about the phony war period of 39-40. Did the Navy also regard it as
no, it was not phony at all for us. We never stopped. I mean, one convoy and another convoy. And then some alarm and out we went and back again. So we had, and there were alarms of U-boats in the Firth of Forth. And then, of course, the Belfast was struck in the Firth of Forth when we were there. She was just doing exercises in the Firth of Forth. Suddenly she blew up.
Did you see it?
Oh, yes.
What did you see?
Well, just an explosion. And the ship got back to Rosyth, where she remained in dry dock. And we always understood she was abandoned, as too badly damaged. And yet she was refitted, and eventually came out and took part in the sinking of the Scharnhorst, didn't she?
Yes.
But the her mining was rather a tricky business, because nobody knew whether it was a mine or a U-boat. So we spent a lot of time searching the Firth of Forth for U-boats.
How far away were you from the Belfast?
Oh, within the area. We were doing a separate exercise, 3 or 4 miles or something.
Did it occur at daytime?
Yes, I can't remember when, but certainly daytime.
Now, you've also mentioned the Cossack. Did you transfer from the Afridi to the Cossack?
Yes, the Afridi and the Cossack, I think, were both immobilized at Rosyth around Christmas time, it must have been, by influenza. So many people were sick that they had to lay the ships up. And I think the Cossack recovered first. I don't really remember how we transferred from the Afridi to the Cossack. I do have a recollection of Captain Vaughan being carried out of his cabin on a stretcher and taken, to the Cossack. The Afridi was anyway about to go and do a refit. So it didn't do much harm that she was out of action, really. But I do have this recollection of him. I hope I'm right. And then we all were called back. We were sent on leave, you see, those who didn't get flu. And we were rung up every night by the one wretched duty staff officer who'd had to remain behind and told it's no good coming back tomorrow. There's no ship ready yet. Every night he rang up this chap. One night he rang up and said, come back tomorrow or tonight, because we can man a ship from what there is. And I went back from Devonshire, where I was living, and went straight to the Cossack.
How well did you get to know Vaughan?
Very well. I served with him later in the Pacific, too.
What kind of a man was he?
I thought he was splendid. Not everyone thought he was splendid. I mean, no one questioned his bravery or anything, but he was difficult to get on with. You either got on with him or you didn't. And if you didn't, you were rather down. And if you did, you were very much up.
What were the kind of qualities in him which you admired?
Decisiveness. Knowing his own mind, and decentralization. He was wonderful at telling you to do a job and then letting you do it. Not all naval officers, senior naval officers in those days, were very good at that. They didn't trust their subordinates all that. Quite rightly, because a subordinate could make an awful mess of the thing. But he gave you a job, and if you did it, you were all right, and if you didn't, you were out.
What kind of aspects in a subordinate might he take particular dislike to?
inefficiency. He was very fair, not bad luck, but inefficiency.
Did you make personal friends of him?
Oh, very much, yes. Very much. I kept up with him till he died. He was a great man, I thought.
Can we go on to the Altmark incident now?
Yeah.
And can you tell me in detail as much of what you remember of it yourself, personally?
Well, it is all very well written by Captain Vaughan, as you know, and there's really nothing which I would say which would change his assessment of the thing. I can only add little personal touches that...
Please.
But we were sent off under Captain Vaughan, who was a senior officer, with one cruiser. I better get these right. Arethusa was a cruiser, the Intrepid, the Ivanhoe, the Mare, and the Seek. And we set off with those ships under his command at about midnight in a thick fog from Rosyth, with orders to do a sweep into the Skaw, SKAW, you know, entrance to the Baltic, to look for enemy shipping. And we did this sweep during the early morning and early part of the next day and found nothing. And during that time, we got a signal from the Admiralty saying, your objective is the Altmark, which we didn't know very much about. We had no picture of her except something in the Illustrated London News, a photograph taken after, I think, the Graaf Spee had been sunk. You know, the prisoners, nearly all were Graaf Spee captured from Graaf Spee targets. And there were two ships in this photograph. There was a four-masted ship of some sort, and way in the distance there was a sort of smudge. And Captain Vaughan and all of us, we agreed that obviously this ship we were after was a four-masted ship. And so we went off to the north, collected our forces, went off to the north to intercept her, because we were told that she was on her way back to Germany and she was about to make contact in Norway and then come down the Leeds, you know?
Yes.
Making her way back. And with this information, we set off. And we arrived halfway up Norway and sent three of our ships, the Arethusa, and a couple of destroyers to the north. It was still daylight, very good weather, and the Cossack and two other destroyers remained on the south end of the line, being about 4 o'clock. Oh no, I don't know what time of day it was, really. Anyway, it was broad daylight. And we spotted a four-masted ship coming down the Leeds and said to ourselves, ha, the Altmark. However, she turned out to be a harmless, neutral Swede. well inside territorial waters. And about the same time, a very good lookout in the Arethusa, who had gone to the north, spotted a ship coming down behind the Swede in the Leeds, which turned out to be the Altmark. So two of the destroyers on the northern bit of the patrol were sent in to intercept this ship. I must keep on saying all within territorial waters, and Norway was neutral. And she refused to stop, and they had to give up. By that time, she'd come in sight of us. And we followed these movements with great interest and saw the Altmark disappear behind some islands and then turn round and disappear again up a fjord. So Captain Vann left the other two destroyers outside under the command of the Arethusa, and we went in to see what was going on. And we reached the mouth of this fjord, where we were met by a... It's all in his book, incidentally. Met by a Norwegian torpedo boat with a torpedo rather menacingly ranged on her upper deck. And we stopped, and the captain came on board, and Captain Vann talked to him with the help of our Norwegian interpreter, who I'd mentioned earlier to you, but not on this tape, I think, called Craven, Lieutenant Craven, who was a reserve officer. And we said we'd come to rescue survivors who we believed to be imprisoned in the Altmark, and would he please allow us to go in and get them off? And he said, on no account. And there were no prisoners in the Altmark. The ship had been searched at Trondheim when she'd made the land the day before, and no one was found on board at all.
What was the manner of this Norwegian?
Nice, quite polite. He got less polite as time went on, not surprisingly. And we said, having been well equipped by signals from the Admiralty, that we knew they were on board. However, he was quite determined, and it was territorial waters, and was getting a bit above our level. The Altmark herself had disappeared into this fjord, so that we weren't worried about keeping an eye on her. And we withdrew outside territorial waters and signaled to the Admiralty what had happened. And all the signals had to be ciphered up. It took a long time. And I can't remember all the details, but we hung around and it got dark. And we got a signal from the Admiralty eventually saying more or less words to that effect, to the effect that we know the prisoners are in the Altmark. Go in and get them. So then we equipped our boarding party under Bradwell Turner, who was the first lieutenant of the Altmark, and steamed in. It was then quite dark, and found our way into this fjord where we saw the Altmark bows towards the shore. Very narrow it was. We had been told, quite wrongly, or I don't mean wrongly, but certainly it wasn't so at the time, that she was equipped with 6-inch guns. So we felt rather dubious about all this. We just had to go in bows first to her stern. We didn't know what armament she had. She turned out to have none at all. The Norwegian gunboat, meanwhile, was hovering. So we got him alongside, and we told him that we had this very definite signal and he could do what he liked. But we were going in. And he came on board, I can't remember when. He came on board the Cossack and came on the bridge. And my recollection is he was there for almost the entire incident.
Where were you at the time?
On the bridge.
What was his demeanour?
He was quiet, and having said we had this signal, he came up. And
had you been kept informed personally as to what was happening?
Or by the captain?
Yes.
Oh, yes. All the signals that came, we were told exactly what was going on. They weren't all that number. We just had this very helpful signal from the Admiralty saying, go in and get them. And so we proceeded to go in on the Altmark's starboard quarter. The boarding party having armed themselves with revolvers and cutlasses and who knows what. And they collected on the forecastle of the Cossack. And the Altmark then proceeded to try and ram us by going astern and working her engines. We couldn't go further away from her propeller because it was too shallow. We had to go alongside her quarter. And, of course, she made a little wash and everything, and it was quite difficult to get safely alongside to let Bradwell Turner and his men jump on board. And this is where he did this wonderful leap. And while we got our bows bumping alongside the Altmark.
Did you see him leap?
Oh, did what?
Did you see him leap?
Oh, Lord, yes. He was on the forecastle. I mean, it was a very small ship. And then the next man, a petty officer, leapt and fell down between the two ships. We were bumping and boring, rather. And Bradwell Turner hauled this petty officer up. And he wasn't hurt. And then we got the bows more satisfactorily alongside, and they all poured on board the Altmark.
What mood were they in when they boarded?
Oh, splendid.
Were they excited?
Very, and longing to go. They'd been hanging around for ages, you see, all this exchange of signals, wondering what was going to happen next. So they were only too pleased to get there. One of the things you have to remember is we had no walkie-talkies in those days. So communication, which is really more important than anything in this sort of occasion, had to be by oldest lamp, flashing lamp. So a signalman went over with them. And we didn't know very much what was going on in the Altmark till eventually we got a signal from Turner saying, I can't remember what it actually said, but it inferred that he'd got control of the ship. And she stopped working her engines. And we were then able to lie rather more quietly and hope that we'd be told something what was going on. And eventually we got another signal from Turner saying that he'd got the captain and several of the officers on the bridge under his control. Meanwhile, although we didn't know this, on the bridge of the Altmark, Turner had said